Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 13. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and joining me today to talk about the princes in the Tower is Matthew Lewis. Matt is an author and historian whose main interest lies in the late medieval period, particularly the Wars of the Roses and Richard III. Matt studied law at university, but history has remained a keen interest since school. To date, he has written two historical fiction novels centred on the Wars of the Roses and the early Tudor years, and several non-fiction histories and biographies ranging from Henry III to Richard, Duke of York, including a book focused on the princes in the Tower. His most recent book is a full biography of the ever-controversial Richard III. My conversation with Matt straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales. Talking Tudors, Matt, please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your background, including what sparked your interest in medieval and Tudor history.
Well, thank you very much for having me on Talking Tudors, Natalie. I've been really enjoying the podcast so far, and some of those guests are a tough act to follow, so I'll do my best. So I've written, incredibly, I've written 11 books so far, which, when I was counting them up, caught me by surprise. It's been a little bit frightening. I've self-published a couple of historical fiction novels, and I self-published a couple of non-fiction books as well, which were centred around Richard III and the Wars of the Roses. And then I started writing a blog, and a publisher got in touch with me through my blog and said they liked what I was writing and the style of writing, and asked me whether I'd like to write some books for them. So once I picked myself up off the floor, the rest was quite literally history, I guess. I think my interest in history really, around the late medieval and early Tudor period, stuck with me since school. I did the Wars of the Roses for A-level history. And I was kind of hooked on it ever since. So it's something I continued reading and studying after school, and now find myself in the crazy position of writing the kind of books that I used to look for on bookshelves.
Right, yes, it's quite surreal, isn't it?
It's weird, it's very strange.
All right, fabulous. Now, one of the 11 books that you've written, which is a very impressive number, by the way, is about the princes in the tower. So a book that I've read and I always recommend to anyone with an interest in this particular subject. Now, the disappearance of the sons of Edward IV is one of the most, I guess, fascinating and controversial mysteries of all time. But on the first page of your book, which I have here next to me, you tell readers that the book does not seek to solve a mystery that has evaded any definitive resolution for five centuries. So I'd love it if you could talk to our listeners about your motives for writing it and what you were hoping to add to this already sort of contentious debate.
Yeah, very contentious, yes. I wanted to be clear from the outset that I didn't want this to be an instructive book that tries to tell the reader what they should believe mm-hmm. and the conclusions that they should reach. I think the fact that it remains a mystery after all of these centuries is because there isn't enough evidence to definitively answer the questions.
Yeah.
And I think when I've read books before, when a writer starts telling me that they've solved the mystery and that this is what I should believe about what happened to the prince in the tower, then it kind of puts me on my guard. Mm. So I didn't want to write something like that. I don't need to think you need to force conclusions onto readers. If someone's picked up a book about the princes in the tower, then they're probably already interested in it and probably quite knowledgeable about it too.
So
I wanted the book to be more like sort of taking a reader by the hand and leading them round what I'd discovered and what I'd learned, and giving them the chance to mull over what they read and to reach their own conclusions.
Yeah.
And I think a controversial topic like the princes, you know, they might take away some of the information and they might, you know, throw the rest over their shoulder and carry on and ignore it. But at least if mm-hmm. they do that, even if they dismiss all of the theories entirely out of hand, then at least hopefully they've given it a bit more thought than they had before. I think I wanted to write this particular book called The Survival of the Princes in the Tower, because I think when historians and other writers talk about the princes, mm-hmm. it's generally to tell readers that they can be, you know, 99% certain that Wicked Uncle Richard killed them. Some will throw in, you know, the kind of 1% is reserved for other suspects and usually one in particular. Mm-hmm. And a few writers will give lip service to the idea that maybe one of the boys could survive. Mm-hmm. But they'll tend to come back and dismiss that as ludicrous and sort of fall back to the traditional position that it was probably Richard that did it. Mm-hmm. So I guess I wanted this book to challenge that and to lay out the various theories that are there and what evidence exists for these theories, and to try and make a coherent case, I guess, for the ideas that the boys might not have been murdered at all in 1483.
Yeah, yeah. And it was a very convincing case, I think, anyway. But before we explore the people who were possibly involved, could you talk to us about the days or the weeks leading up to their so-called disappearance? When were the boys last seen in public?
Yeah, definitely. This is kind of, it's all shrouded in mystery even at this point. So Edward IV dies in early April 1483, just before his 41st birthday.
Yes.
His date of death is usually given as the 9th of April. Mm-hmm. But the late Dr. John Ashdown Hill made a case recently for the idea that his death could have happened a few days earlier and been covered up, much in the same way that Henry VII was in 1509. Not least because we get a message that's recorded in the York House books, which is the civic records for the city of York. Mm-hmm. A couple of days before Edward's supposed death, a message arrives to say that the king's died, and they start preparing funeral masses and things like that.
Right.
And then we get this other message arrive later to say, well, actually he died on the 9th of April. So it's kind of weird, given that Edward's death is said to be, you know, sudden and unexpected, that we get this message arriving there a couple of days earlier. And a theory that maybe there was, you know, there was definitely lots of factions in London, and lots of infighting starting and lots of panic when Edward IV dies. So the idea is much in the same way as Henry VII's death. So it's kept quiet for a few days to give people time to position themselves properly before they announce the king's death and have to deal with the fallout of that. So at this point, we've got the new king, effectively King Edward V, is a 12-year-old boy, and he's living at Ludlow on the Welsh border, where he's been for most of his life. So he's about 150 miles away from London. He's been there since he was a very small child, in a kind of, the idea Edward IV had was to use Wales and the Council of the Marches, centred on Ludlow, as kind of a little miniature kingdom in which he could train Edward V, how kingdoms work and how to operate. So he's been there, as I say, for most of his life so far, with his uncle, his maternal uncle, Anthony Woodville, the Earl Rivers, who's Elizabeth Woodville, the Queen's sister. Edward's younger brother, Richard, Duke of York, who's not to be confused with his granddad, Richard, Duke of York, or his uncle, Richard, Duke of Gloucester, who people think is Richard, Duke of York. So everyone's called Richard.
Everyone's called York. Richard. Yeah, that's so confusing.
Not called Richard, they're called Edward. and all the women are called Elizabeth. So
Exactly.
it all gets very confusing. But this Richard Duke of York, he's nine, and he's in London. He stayed at court with his mother and his sisters. And I think there we see strong parallels, which I think are no accident, between Prince Arthur Tudor and the future Henry VIII in the ways that they're brought up. I think Henry VII kind of looks at Edward IV's model and sees a lot of benefit in it. And I think it's important from that distinction in their backgrounds to realise that despite what Victorian portrait artists have often tried to tell us, these weren't two really close boys, you know, clinging to each other in the Tower of London, looking around in panic for who was about to kill them. They were brought up very separately and very differently. But in terms of what happens in 1483, Edward V arrives in London on the 4th of May, which is the date that his mother and the council had originally set for his coronation.
Right.
So he met his uncle, Richard, Duke of Gloucester, on the road to London. Richard's coming down from York, and he meets up with them moving from Ludlow.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably at least one, if not an entire series of podcasts in what happens between Ludlow and London.
Yes, so I can imagine.
To leave that to one side for now.
Yeah.
But Richard effectively takes control of the person of the new king of Edward V,
mm-hmm.
and he arrests Anthony Woodville and a couple of other members of Edward's household and has them sent up north.
Mm-hmm.
So Richard then kind of deliberately puts the brakes on and slows things down. There's no rush now to London to get to a coronation on the 4th of May. And I think it's probably deliberate that he arrives in London on the 4th of May.
Right.
And Richard's saying, you know, let's just take the heat out of this. Let's slow down. There's no rush.
Mm.
And the chaos that's going on in London before Richard arrives is really well documented. It's interesting. People tend to think that Richard arrived in London and caused problems and caused chaos.
Right.
But in fact, there was armed men in the streets, some from the Woodville faction, some from William Hastings' faction.
Right.
William Hastings, kind of Edward IV's best mate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're already in the streets with weapons out and armed and ready to go. But Richard installs Edward V at the Bishop of London's palace next to St. Paul's when they arrive in London.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Richard sends people there to swear oaths to Edward V, which is a dangerous thing to do if you think Richard's after the throne at this point, because swearing oaths was taken lightly, you know.
Mm.
But council meets and Richard is installed as protector for Edward V,
mm-hmm.
though a lot of the chronicles talk about him being given the powers of a regent rather than a protector, and a protector in the way that Richard's father, Richard Duke of York, had been protector was a kind of weirdly English distinction. It's a technical thing, but it can help to understand what Richard was doing in 1483
mm-hmm.
if we make that distinction. And at this point, council also agrees to move Edward V from the Bishop of London's palace into the Tower of London. And Dominic Mancini and some of the other commentators try to see something sinister in this with the application of hindsight.
Yes,
The Tower at this point, more than anything else, was a royal palace. You know, it was a prison and it was a royal armory and it was the royal treasury at times and all this kind of thing.
Mm.
But it was a palace above anything else. And it was where medieval monarchs traditionally went to prepare for their coronation. So there's really nothing
sinister at
that point.
Mm-hmm.
And Little Richard, Duke of York, at this point is in sanctuary at Westminster Abbey with his mother. She fled to sanctuary when Richard took control of the person of Edward V at Stony Stratford.
Right.
And there's lots of discussion about why did she do that? Was she terrified of Richard? Is this a guilty conscience? You know, it's hard to pick apart why she was doing what she was doing.
Right.
But Richard and the council do try to convince Elizabeth to come out of sanctuary, but she flatly refuses. And mm-hmm. in the end, they send the Archbishop of Canterbury to ask Elizabeth to allow her youngest son, Richard, to come out of sanctuary and to go to the Tower and join his brother to prepare for his own part in the coronation and provide a bit of company for Edward V as well. So that happens on the 16th of June. Richard comes out of sanctuary and goes to the Tower. And at this point, Edward's coronation has been rescheduled for the 22nd of June, with Parliament to open on the 25th of June.
Right.
But instead, on the 22nd of June, we then get this sermon preached at St. Paul's Cross, at which the illegitimacy of Edward IV's marriage and his children is raised. So again, it's probably a whole other podcast in that.
Yeah.
But one of the things that comes out, I don't think there was ever a question, as Dominic Mancini says, about Edward IV's personal illegitimacy. So whether Edward IV was really his father's son kind of thing.
Right.
Okay. Dominic Mancini says that that's what the sermon was about. But I think it was all about Edward's marriage to Elizabeth Woodville mm-hmm. and the legitimacy of his children.
Right. Yes.
So then the boys kind of, you know, then we get the whole roller coaster of Richard being offered the throne, accepting the throne, his coronation on the 6th of July. And the boys Obviously, Edward V has to be moved out of the royal apartments because now Richard III needs those to prepare for his own coronation. But after this point, we have no kind of dated sightings of the boys at all. We get these references to them being seen playing in the garden, shooting with bows and arrows at various times in the garden.
Yes,
but nobody true. Provides a date at which was the last time that they were ever seen by anyone. So we don't really know when they disappeared.
Okay. Now, that it really is a tangled tale, isn't it? It kind of hurts my brain trying to work it all out. But anyway, so the traditional and prevailing belief, and you've already touched on this, is that Richard III ordered the murder of his nephews, Edward and Richard. What are the main arguments, I suppose, used by people who subscribe to this theory?
I think the... in terms of Richard III's guilt, probably the most simple thing that people fall back on is Occam's razor. Mm. You know, if whatever's the simplest explanation is probably the correct one.
Yeah.
So the boys were in Richard's care when they disappeared. He's the king. He's the most powerful man around. He's responsible for the boys. Mm-hmm. And they disappear and they're never heard of again. He never offers an explanation for what happened to them. Mm. And that works perfectly well. It makes sense. It's kind of the easy answer to it all. But I also kind of think, you know, if murder mysteries, it was always the obvious person, then, you know, Agatha Christie wouldn't have had much of a career, would she?
That's right.
There's normally twists in there somewhere. It's not always as easy as people think it was.
Okay. So if the princes, let's just say the princes were murdered in 1483, but Richard wasn't involved, who are the other main suspects that we have?
The main suspect that other people will point to is Henry Stafford, who's the Duke of Buckingham.
So
he's a couple of years younger than Richard III, and he's really been in the political wilderness during Edward IV's reign. Edward obviously didn't see anything in Henry Stafford that he liked or thought was useful, perhaps saw something in him that he thought was dangerous. If he did, then Richard III definitely missed that. So Buckingham becomes attached to Richard as he moves south in 1483 for that meeting at Stony Stratford. Mm-hmm. And we don't know who contacted who. We don't know whether Richard got in touch with Buckingham or Buckingham got in touch with Richard. Mm-hmm. But they meet up at Stony Stratford. And Buckingham then becomes really central to Richard establishing himself in London first as protector, but then he starts to take the throne as well. Buckingham's right at his side, driving all of those things through. And Buckingham gets lots of rewards for this. He's made a virtual regent in Wales. He's kind of second in authority in the whole country. He's getting, you know, offices and lands and money. It's all flowing his way. But then in October 1483, we get these rebellions against Richard III. And Buckingham, for some reason, joins the rebellions. And it's hard to see what he hoped to gain by that. You know, he's already the second most powerful man in the country. He's getting all of these rewards from Richard. Mm. But something makes him turn away and join these rebellions. So that could be that Richard killed the princes and disapproved. But it might also be that Buckingham's killed the princes and Richard is outraged.
Yeah.
You know, Buckingham thought he was doing Richard a favour. Maybe Buckingham had his own motives for wanting to do it. He has a perfectly good, fairly strong Lancastrian claim to the throne. You know, if we're looking for other claimants to the throne in 1483, Buckingham's claim is arguably much, much better than someone like Henry Tudor's claim at this point. And we get Richard writing to his Chancellor, John Russell, from Nottingham, asking him to send the royal seal. And we get this handwritten postscript to the letter in which Richard kind of rails against Buckingham and calls him all sorts of names, the most untrue creature living. So was this because Richard found out that Buckingham has done something outrageous, killed the princes maybe, or is it simply that Richard can't deal with the betrayal from the man who he's treated so well? And we get these odd kind of scraps of evidence. So we get scraps of evidence that start to point to Richard, but we get scraps that point to Buckingham. So there's a little piece that says the boys were killed at the prompting of the Duke of Buckingham, as it is said. Get another piece that tells us that the boys were put to death in the Tower by the vise of the Duke of Buckingham. But vise is a word that can mean the advice, so he advised Richard to do it, or it can mean the device of the Duke of Buckingham, his scheme. So it's all still really messy, you know, it's hard to pick apart. And there is, you know, there's another suspect. I think you're setting a little trap for me here to walk into. I'm going to jump into it with both feet.
Go for it. Do it.
I think the most often suggested other suspect is Margaret Beaufort.
Yes. I just wrote her name down, waiting for you to...
Absolutely, yeah. You know, I can hear eyes rolling everywhere as people are listening to this. But first, you know, firstly, people who want to rubbish the claim will usually tell me that Margaret had to murder this whole swathe of other Yorkist heirs if she wanted to clear the path to the throne for her son. Mm-hmm. But that's just demonstrably not true. Henry Tudor invades England in October 1483 as part of those rebellions. And the stated aim of that rebellion is to place Henry on the throne. Now, the Crowland Chronicler tells us that as part of these October rebellions, a rumour was started that the princes were dead. Mm-hmm. And he never reports any more than a rumour. So there were no definite murders in October 1483, and no other Yorkist heirs are removed. But we have Henry here trying to land on the south coast to claim Richard's throne mm-hmm. in October 1483. So I guess, you know, there wasn't a need to kill any Yorkist heirs, never mind a great swathe of them. And Henry did claim the throne in October 1483. He didn't wait till 1485 to do that. But I think, you know, my biggest get out of jail free card here is that I'm not trying to claim that Margaret Beaufort did it, because I'm trying to claim that no one did it.
Mm. Okay, thank you. So Duke of Buckingham, Margaret Beaufort, they're basically the main other sort of suspects.
Yeah, mate, you know, there are other people you can line up along that. People have suggested John Howard, the Duke of Norfolk, and, you know, any random sort of person who might have to do it, that they might have been killed during a botched attempt to free them from the Tower by their mother. And the Woodville faction, you know, there are a few other theories around their deaths, but I think, you know, Buckingham is the main alternative suspect, and Margaret Beaufort is one who attracts a bit of attention as well.
Okay.
There's quite often fierce defended as she is attacked for it. So.
Yeah, well, exactly. So one of the reasons why I find your book really fascinating is that apart from the very thorough and I think really impartial examination of the context surrounding their disappearance, you pose a very intriguing question. You sort of alluded to it earlier. What if Edward V and his brother Richard, Duke of York, survived the reign of Richard III and even that of his successor, Henry VII? What evidence is there to support this idea?
It's fascinating theories all around this. I think the first thing you have to say is that any evidence, and I'm probably doing air quotes when I say evidence, mm-hmm. Is almost exclusively circumstantial. But I'd say probably say the same for the case for their murders, you know, but that all relies on circumstantial evidence as well. Mm-hmm. If there was a definite answer out there, it wouldn't be a mystery, would it?
Yeah, exactly.
I think one of the theories that's fascinated me for decades, ever since I first read about it, is Jack Leslaw's theory.
Yeah.
That both of the princes lived kind of hidden in plain sight in Tudor England into the reign of Henry VIII. So Jack Leslaw was an amateur art historian mm-hmm. Who believed that he decoded a series of hidden messages within Hans Holbein's portrait of Sir Thomas More and his family.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
And if nothing else, you know, that idea makes More's part in the construction of the story of the murder of the princes in the Tower, you know, his is the most famous version of it.
That's right.
Certainly before Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. It makes his part in all of that very interesting. And when we think about More, he abandoned what he was writing about Richard III around 1515. He never completed it mm-hmm. Or published it. You know, he entered royal service instead. It was finished about 10 years after his execution by his nephew, who wrote the end of it and then published it. So you're left kind of wondering what did More find that caused him to abandon mm-hmm. what he was writing. I think a lot of people will you know, laugh the idea off that the boys could have survived. But I think if we can accept for kind of a few moments that maybe Richard III wasn't a child-killing homicidal maniac, Henry VII wasn't one either, then we're left with the question of what do you do with the sons of Edward IV if they are still around. Mm-hmm. So it's possible that their continued existence contributes to the increasing fear and paranoia that we see in Henry VII as he starts to get older, particularly after his wife Elizabeth of York dies. Mm-hmm. It's possible, you know, do we think Henry VIII, as a 17-year-old, that athletic, confident man, would have tolerated Yorkist heirs hanging around his court? Well, he did, you know. He had his uncle, Arthur Plantagenet, who was an illegitimate son of Edward IV, at court for an awfully long time, and he was very fond of him.
That's right.
Okay, Arthur was illegitimate, so it's a slightly different matter. But in the end, he falls foul of Henry's paranoia years later. Mm. And maybe the fact that two legitimate sons of Edward IV had lived contributed to Henry's kind of increasing paranoia, amongst other things. I think one of the most compelling kind of pieces of evidence for the fact that the princes weren't murdered is the silence that surrounds the matter in 1485, even after the Battle of Bosworth and when Richard III is dead. Mm. Even at this point, when it would suit the new Tudor regime to have the matter cleared up and to be able to say that the boys are dead and they're definitely gone. We get Elizabeth Woodville, their mother, never once accuses Richard of killing her sons before she dies in 1492. So, you know, 7 years of Tudor rule, and she says absolutely nothing against Richard. Mm. Elizabeth of York, who is the sister of the princess in the tower, marries Henry VII, and her children, you know, then become next in line for the throne. But she remains silent on the fate of her brother. And in fact, she keeps a book in her own library that she got from her uncle Richard's library. And Richard assigned his name in the front of the book, and she writes her own name underneath that. And that's, you know, that's an odd thing to do for a guy you think has killed your brothers.
Yeah.
It doesn't really make too much sense, does it?
It doesn't. No, it's so. I think you're right. That silence is completely perplexing.
I've seen that kind of described as the negative evidence.
Right.
So you would think if everybody knew that Richard had killed the princes, Elizabeth Woodville, Elizabeth of York, you know, even Henry Tudor never makes a statement saying Richard III killed Edward V, Richard Duke of York. You would have thought all of these people would have come out and said it when they felt safe to do so.
Yeah. Gosh, it's tricky, isn't it?
It is.
Very confused. I have heard the argument that it was this sort of fear of this cult of sainthood sort of, you know, emerging around the boys, and that's why people kept silent. But I don't know. That's, you know, just another sort of thread in this very tangled.
Richard III himself, you know, tries to harness a little bit of a cult of sainthood that's developing around Henry VI.
That's right.
Yeah. And again, you know, there's probably a whole other podcast in the relationship between Richard III and Henry VI's death. You know, Richard's one of the people suspected of killing Henry VI.
Yes.
So Richard moves Henry's body into Windsor Chapel, probably to harness part of the growing cult of sainthood around him. And, you know, Henry VII tries to have Henry VI sainted later. Mm-hmm. So there is an argument that says maybe they were scared of this, but I think in terms of political reality, for both Richard III, if the boys were dead and gone, you would want people to know that they weren't available to be used as a threat. And I think the same is true of Henry VII. You know, he has to re-legitimise the boys in order to legitimise Elizabeth of York so he can marry her. So they become an even greater threat to him than they've been to Richard III.
Yeah.
So politically, I would have thought there was far more mileage in making sure everyone knew that they were dead than worrying about the possible cult of sainthood that might spring up around them, especially for Henry. If he can say Richard III killed them, he could harness that cult of sainthood
to his advantage. Yeah, definitely.
Okay,
so it's difficult to talk about the princes in the tower without mentioning Lambert Simnel and Perkin Warbeck. So maybe let's look at Simnel first. He's gone down in history as a pretender to the throne who in 1487, during the reign of Henry VII, claimed to be Edward Plantagenet, son of George Plantagenet, Duke of Clarence. Now, this has always kind of confused me a little, especially considering that Edward Plantagenet had been a prisoner in the tower since Richard III's death in 1485. And as far as I know, this was kind of public knowledge. So it just doesn't make any sense to me. In your book, you question this long accepted story. I'd love it if you could tell us about the explanations that you offer in your book about this.
Definitely, yes. I think it's all of the things that don't make sense about the Lambert Simnel affair that start to ring alarm bells.
Yeah.
And I think one of the first things to point out when we talk about kind of Lambert Simnel and Perkin Warbeck is that they're always described as pretenders, which is a different thing to being an imposter. So the word pretender is derived from the French verb prétendre, to claim. So a pretender is just someone who has a claim to the throne.
Right.
So, for example, we get James Stuart being the son of James II, being called the old pretender. Mm-hmm. And that's not to doubt who he was or that he was the genuine son of James II. It just means that he had a claim to the throne. So an imposter would be a more correct description for someone who lies about their identity to claim to be someone else.
Right.
So I think it's quite interesting maybe that Lambert and Perkin have gone down in history as pretenders rather than imposters.
Mm.
And I think we can see a little bit here as well of the return of Occam's razor. So if people say the simplest explanation is always the right one, then two boys disappeared in 1483 and two serious pretenders threatened Henry VII in the years that followed the Battle of Bosworth. So there's an argument for saying the simple explanation is there's your two boys. But so, yeah, as you described, you know, the traditional story is that Lambert Simnel was this boy from Oxford who was taken over to Ireland by a priest and trained to impersonate Edward, Earl of Warwick, who was the son of George, Duke of Clarence, who was the brother of Edward IV and Richard III. So the Earl of Warwick is a cousin of the princes in the tower. But that story only comes from the Tudor side of the affair. So we have no record from within the Yorkist contingent of who they were claiming the boy to be. We don't get regnal numbers being used by their side, so we can tell whether this is Edward VI or Edward V.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, you know, a revolt in favour of Edward Earl of Warwick in 1487 kind of makes no sense.
Yeah.
He's been an orphan, you know, and a prisoner for most of his life. His mom died when he was very little. His father was executed in 1478. And then he goes into wardship of the Woodvilles first, and then Richard III sort of looks after him, actually better than he's been looked after before Richard III's reign, and better than he'll be looked after Richard III's reign. So he has no kind of real natural support base of people who are going to cohere around him. He's 12 years old, so he's not, you know, an adult male who's looking to lead a rebellion. And also, as you say, he's demonstrably a prisoner in the Tower of London, and Henry VII does wheel him out in London and makes him appear at St. Paul's and talk to lots of nobility to make a nonsense of what's going on in Ireland at this point. And you wonder whether someone didn't just hit on the idea that, you know, well, they claim they've got an Edward in Ireland and we've got an Edward right here, you know, but let's make the most of the fact that everyone's called Edward. So it'd be easy to say that that boy in Ireland is just claiming to be this Edward that we've got, who's a prisoner in the Tower. And again, I think the human kind of aspect of it, the actions of those who are interested and revolving around this affair, can be quite interesting. So in the case of Lambert Simnel, we get Elizabeth Woodville, the Princess in the Tower's mother, heavily implicated in the Lambert Simnel affair. So she's deprived of all of her property. She retires to Bermondsey Abbey in early 1487. And this decision is made at a council in January, which is the same council that's discussing what's going on in Ireland and trying to decide what to do. So Polydore Vergil, who's kind of Henry VII's sort of official historian, tells us that this was because of Henry VII's outrage in 1487 that Elizabeth had handed her daughters over to Richard III in 1484. Right. But that kind of didn't really wash, you know, it's 3 years later.
Yeah.
But also her oldest son, Thomas Grey, the Marquis of Dorset, is arrested at the same time. And when he's asked why he's being seized and thrown in the Tower of London, he's reportedly told that if he's loyal to Henry VII, then he won't mind a spell in prison to prove it. Which is some interesting logic, I guess. But the question, I think, is what do the Woodville faction have to gain by promoting the cause of Edward Earl of Warwick? Elizabeth Woodville, you know, she's often implicated in George Duke of Clarence's execution as the one who egged Edward IV on to do it. So she can hardly expect, you know, a warm welcome from George's son. And from Elizabeth Woodville's point of view, her daughter is already sitting on the throne as queen consort, and she's got a grandson in Arthur who's going to inherit next. So what, in 1487, what could possibly place Elizabeth Woodville in a better position than having one of her daughters on the throne as a queen consort? But I think the only thing is to have her son on the throne as king, if he's still alive. And I think the other person whose actions are quite interesting in all of this are John de la Pole, who's the Earl of Lincoln. He's the oldest nephew of Edward IV and Richard III. So he's the oldest son of their sister, Elizabeth, Duchess of Suffolk. So he's a genuine Yorkist heir, albeit his claim might come down the female line, but the entire Yorkist claim is passed through the female line of Mortimer descent. He's a grown man. He's in his early 20s. No one doubted who he was. He's politically active. He's been trained during Richard III's reign. So why would you not follow him, rather than some random boy from Oxford who's pretending to be an earl who has no support and is a prisoner in the Tower? Why does John de la Pole set aside his own claim to follow that boy?
Yes.
There are only two people in 1487 who could have a better Yorkist claim to the throne than John de la Pole if they were still alive, and that's the princes in the Tower. Lambert Simnel, you know, he undergoes a coronation in Dublin before the invasion of England takes place. And that's an oddity. You know, we never get Perkin Warbeck trying to undergo a coronation. And a coronation, it's, you know, it's a solemn and sacred affair. It's not something, again, like the swearing of oaths. It's not something that people would do lightly.
That's right,
But Edward V, if we think about Edward V, he's been proclaimed king in 1483, but a coronation was kind of the missing piece of his kingship. So he was never crowned. So maybe the symbolic coronation in Dublin was meant to complete Edward V's kingship, and that might explain why we get the coronation. But we get all sorts of interesting stuff in some of the chronicles and very Tudor chronicles. So Polydore Vergil and Bernard Andre have very interesting things to say about the Lambert Simnel affair.
Right.
Polydore Vergil, for example, at one point talks in his Latin manuscript about this being a plan to restore Edward to the throne, without saying which Edward he's talking about.
Right.
But Warwick has never been king, so he can't be restored.
To his throne.
The only Edward who could be restored to a throne in 1487 is Edward V, if he's still alive.
Yeah.
We get Bernard Andre to say that he's, you know, the blind friar poet who acts as a tutor to Prince Arthur, so really at the centre of Tudor affairs and a big fan of Henry VII. He refers explicitly to the boy in Ireland claiming to be a son of Edward IV and this being accepted by a great many people. He makes no mention at all of this being in favour of the Earl of Warwick. As late as 1526, we get a report that's prepared for Henry VIII on the state of Irish affairs, so that, you know, there's fresh trouble bubbling up in Ireland, and he's obviously asked someone to go away and write him a little précis of what Ireland is all about. Mm-hmm. And this report, that is for the king's eyes only, really, refers to the Lambert-Simnel affair and says that he was named one of King Edward's sons. So again, we get this story that he doesn't claim to be George, Duke of Clarence's son. We've got several Tudor sources saying that he claimed to be King Edward's son. So unless someone made a mistake, you have to wonder whether these people didn't have to worry about hiding behind the Tudor version of events, because this was a private report for Henry VIII, who would know the truth of what had happened.
The truth, yeah.
And we get, you know, this one quite amusing story in the Book of Howth, which is an Irish account of the Lords of Howth, and its reliability is kind of open to question, I guess.
Right.
But no, it's interesting and it's quite amusing. So the Book of Howth tells us that Henry summons all of the Irish lords over to London in the wake of the Lambert-Simnel affair to slap all of their wrists and try and make them behave. Mm-hmm. And as a joke, Henry gets the boy who was captured at the Battle of Stoke Field, so this would be Lambert-Simnel,
right,
to go into the feast and serve wine to all of these Irish lords.
Right.
And when no one says anything, Henry has someone pull the boy to the front of the hall and do a big reveal and say, ha-ha, you know, you've been served wine by this boy who you had crowned as a king in Dublin. Ha-ha, you've all been fooled.
Right.
You know, and he's greeted with complete silence. You know, I'm sure there's medieval tumbleweed rolling across the room. And all of these Irish lords begin to swear oaths, you know, to God and the devil that they've never seen this boy before.
Right. Wow.
So you have to wonder then whether Henry doesn't wonder who this boy is that he's got in his custody. Mm. So I think it's all interesting without being able to prove anything beyond a doubt.
Gosh, it's absolutely fascinating, isn't it? So in 1490, Perkin Warbeck comes on the scene. Now, he's claiming to be Richard of Shrewsbury, Duke of York, the younger of the princes. He's eventually captured. That's another long story in between that. But anyway, he's eventually captured by Henry VII and allegedly confesses to being an imposter. And in November 1499, he's executed. 5 days later, Edward Plantagenet, who'd been in prison since the age of 10, is also executed. So in your opinion, do you think it's possible that Perkin Warbeck was in fact the son of Edward IV and Elizabeth Woodville, so the younger prince?
Yeah, yeah. And Perkin Warbeck's career is so fascinating in its own right. Whether you happen to believe that he was or wasn't the real Richard of England, which is what he called himself, it's a fascinating story. You know, he's a young man who's courted by the crowned heads of Europe and treated like a prince everywhere he goes, married to a beautiful Scottish noblewoman in Catherine Gordon, invades England on several occasions. You know, they don't write much better stories in Hollywood, really, do they?
No,
But I think you have to be... I think you would have to be incredibly narrow-minded to say that there was absolutely no chance that Perkin was the genuine Richard, Duke of York, whilst admitting at the same time that it's impossible to say that he was. Yeah. The support of foreign rulers, I think, is often seen kind of as a symptom of their desire to cause trouble for Henry VII. Mm-hmm. But I think that ignores their own kind of what must have been a really entrenched sense of the sanctity of royalty.
Absolutely.
And how that position is removed from the rest of the world. You know, you don't hold up a boy from Tournai who's a nobody as a rightful king of a country without devaluing your own prestige and the sanctity of your own royalty. Mm. And I think Margaret of Burgundy, you know, she's a sister of Edward IV and Richard III, so an aunt of the princes in the Tower. She's another fascinating person in all of this. She's often considered as being the one who really wanted to do damage to Henry VII, and she definitely did.
Yeah.
But if her desire is to restore the legitimate House of York, then she doesn't achieve that by championing Perkin if she knows he's an imposter. Mm-hmm. Why didn't she favour John de la Pole in 1487? Because she backed the Lambert-Simnel affair as well. Why does she not favour John de la Pole's brothers in the 1490s? You know, they would go on to cause trouble for the Tudors after Perkin Warbeck is dead. Interestingly, again, it makes Perkin Warbeck to be dead. So Richard, Duke of York's by no means the only option. And especially if he's dead, you know, there's living people who are genuine Yorkist heirs.
Yeah.
Why not champion one of these candidates? And I think that Perkin Warbeck's confession, if you read it, I think it reads an awful lot like something that was written for him and handed to sign. There's lots of it that doesn't add up. The story changes in quite major ways between sort of the early days of his confession, and as that becomes refined, the story changes, some of the names in it changes. So maybe Perkin had just lied for so long that he'd forgotten what the truth was. Mm. But maybe he just wasn't Perkin Warbeck from Tournai at all. You know, if in 1487 it had worked to claim that this was a nobody boy with a funny name,
yeah,
why not try it again in the 1490s? And I think probably one of the most interesting things about the whole Perkin Warbeck affair, you know, we can argue endlessly about his entire career and who he may or may not have been. But if we look at what the Spanish were doing during the 1490s, when the Spanish write to ambassadors, and when ambassadors write back to the King and Queen of Spain, they write these letters in code. Mm-hmm. So when these letters were translated, there was a kind of handbook for all of these codes that was included in there. And there's a section in this code book that says specifically that it's reserved for the Pope and for members of European royal families. And the preamble to this section specifically says, if you're looking for someone who isn't a member of a royal family, then look somewhere else because they won't be here. And in this list of codes, we get kind of sandwiched between Margaret, the Duchess of Burgundy, and King Alfonso of Naples. We get a code which is DCCCCVII, and the name next to that is Richard, Duke of York, son of Edward IV. And that's the code that the Spanish use in all of their encoded sort of letters backwards and forwards between England and Spain to refer to Perkin Warbeck throughout the 1490s. Goodness. So they don't ever refer to Perkin Warbeck. They refer to Prince Richard, the Duke of York. And it kind of makes you wonder in 1499 whether, you know, we're told that the Spanish wanted rid of Warwick as a genuine Yorkist threat before Catherine of Aragon was allowed to arrive in England. Mm. But if they were at least suspicious that Perkin was real, then you have to wonder whether they weren't more interested in getting rid of the potential Richard, Duke of York, than they were of Warwick, really.
Mm. And interesting that they both die within days of each other.
Yeah,
so.
And they concoct this plot that they're trying to escape the tower together.
Yeah.
And just as an excuse to be done with both of them at the same time. And I think people often think, you know, clearing up Perkin was a beneficial side effect of having to kill Warwick to appease the Spanish. But I kind of wonder whether it wasn't the other way around. Killing Warwick was kind of the cover for being rid of Perkin Warbeck, which is what the Spanish might have really wanted.
Goodness. Oh, my gosh. What a story. It's incredible.
Just to make
that,
it
really. Yeah, you just couldn't make it up, could you? Now, I think listeners will be a bit cranky if I don't ask you the question that after all these years of research, and obviously you've done a lot of reflection on all of this, what do you personally think happened to the sons of King Edward IV, Edward and Richard?
I think if I'm pushed, I think I'm becoming increasingly convinced that Edward V led the Yorkist invasion of 1487 that's remembered as the Lambert-Simnel affair. I think there's too much about that doesn't add up if it was Edward Earl of Warwick that makes sense if it was Edward V. What happened to him after the Battle of Stoke Field, I'm probably less certain about at the moment. He could have been killed at the battlefield. You know, he was 16, kind of 16 and a half by this point, which was an age when young men were allowed to take the field of battle. People were killed in the Wars of the Roses at 17, kind of thing. So he could have been killed on the battlefield. Well, you get one continental source that tells us that one of the Earl of Lincoln's brothers rescues the boy and spirits him away to Europe. But we don't know what happens to him after that. Maybe he's captured and we get a bargain struck that sees him live out a life of kind of comfortable obscurity, which is where Jack Leslaw's theory might come in, that they, you know, live in plain sight and it was sort of an open secret. And I think equally, I find the idea that Perkin was really Richard, Duke of York, just so compelling. Mm. According to Bernard Andre and the Spanish ambassador de Puebla, he's beaten round the face until he's disfigured.
Yes.
De Puebla uses this famous word disfigurado, which is often translated as changed, but it actually just means disfigured. And was this because he looked so much like Richard, Duke of York? I mean, Richard, Duke of York was the one of the princes who would have been far more recognisable in London. He grew up around the royal palaces.
Exactly, that's right.
His face could well have been really dangerous. So were the beatings the solution to that kind of problem? And if he was genuine, then he was executed in 1499. Unless we get some weird conspiracy theory about him being swapped and a different person being... Oh, I don't know. We could go on for hours and hours about this. But we get talk in some of the sources about Perkin Warbeck having at least one child and the possibility that Catherine Gordon was pregnant when they're captured. We get one of the ship's captains saying he's cautious of taking them to land on the south coast of England with their child.
Right.
So Leslaw's theory, when he talks about Richard Duke of York appearing in this Moore family portrait, could that apply to a son of Richard Duke of York? Because we get all sorts of confusion about the age of this person who's in the portrait. And I think, just ultimately, I think I find it hard to believe, based on years of you know, studying Richard III, I'm one of those loony Ricardians. I just find it so hard that looking at his life before and after the spring and summer of 1483, that his first response to a crisis is to murder two children.
Yeah.
And his nephews as well, you know, after all of those years of service to his brother. I just find it hard to believe that's his kind of first go-to answer to a problem. He just doesn't behave like that. I mean, we could probably have another podcast discussion about Anthony Woodville and William Hastings, who do get executed by Richard in 1483, but to me they're a completely different matter. So if Richard didn't kill them, and I don't think he did, whilst we have to acknowledge that it was entirely possible, then I guess you're just left wondering, you know, what about the survivor of the princes in the tower as something that people haven't considered enough?
Yeah, look, I absolutely love it. You've certainly given me a lot of food for thought, and I think the listeners will be thinking the same thing, and you really inspired me, I suppose, to start questioning some of those really traditional stories and maybe delving into it a little deeper myself. So that, you know, that's fantastic.
Brilliant. I think that's what I wanted to go for, just, you know, to encourage people to just look at it again. I'm not saying the traditional story is wrong. I'm not saying my version or any of the versions I lay out are right. I'm just saying, you know, just take a step back and look at it again.
Yeah, well, I think you've absolutely succeeded there. So we're at the time to play 10 to go. Are you ready, Matt?
I think so.
Okay, so name two items that are on your bucket list.
I would love to go to Jerusalem.
Oh, okay.
I just think one of the most fascinating places in the world. You know, study medieval history, and so much of medieval history focuses on the Holy Land and the Crusades.
Yeah.
And from a personal spiritual point of view, I guess, you know, it's just one of those places I would love to visit. I'd love to be able to go before I kick the bucket.
All right. I think one other, yep.
Well, I think most of them revolve around travel, you know. I'm probably not a well-travelled person at the moment. I'd love to go to Rome for similar reasons, you know, just to see the history. Mm-hmm. I just find places like that so fascinating.
Absolutely, I agree with you. What's one of your earliest childhood memories?
One of my earliest childhood memories, and my brother will hate me if he ever listens to this. I remember my brother riding his trike backwards into the pond in our garden. I have no idea how he did it, and I remember him getting into loads of trouble for it. Oh, he was on this little trike, and he obviously got on it and tried to pedal forwards, but managed to pedal backwards and fell into this little fish pond that we had, and, you know, got into a whole world of trouble. And I just remember thinking it was absolutely hilarious, both because he'd gone in the pond and because he got into trouble for it.
Do you know what? I think I did something. I remember riding my bike into a pond at a park once as well. You just reminded me there. Gosh. Okay, so what's one of the books you're currently reading?
I have just finished reading, actually, John Ashton Hill's Mythology of the Princes in the Tower,
right,
so sticking
on
topic. And he raises some very interesting points in that. I don't necessarily agree with everything that's in there. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, it just goes to show that there's still lots that can be said about that subject. And I think at the moment I'm looking to read my next book on the pile when it... Yeah, the pile is huge. I'm sure yours is huge.
I can imagine. Yeah,
books work their way to the top. I guess I've got La Reine Blanche by Sarah Bryson.
Oh, lovely. Yes, so. I've got that here as well. I'm going to get to it. I am going to get to it.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Now, you've mentioned travel. You enjoy traveling. So what's one of your favourite holiday destinations?
We go to Wales a lot. We live not too far from kind of the Welsh border. So Wales for us, the Welsh coast is like a straight line to the sea. And it's a bit of an escape. So we go to Aberystwyth quite a lot. It's just a really nice town. There's the remains of a castle there. So I get to wander around a castle while my wife and the kids wander around shops.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's got a little bit of everything for all of us. And just being by the sea, I just love being by the sea.
Okay, fantastic. That sounds good to me. Describe a day in your life when you're writing. Are there any sort of rituals that you like to follow?
I try to procrastinate because I convince myself that I need a tidy desk to write at. So when I'm doing research and things, you know, spread everywhere, bits of paper, all sorts of other stuff that's not even to do with writing as well. So I sit down to write and I think, you know what, I'm going to tidy my desk first. So I like to have like a tidy desk around me when I start writing. I like to start writing as early as I can. So as soon as I get up, I want to go and write almost as if, you know, the creative juices all wear out
exactly,
at some point in the day.
Yeah,
And sometimes I think you have to write something, even if you know it's not very good when you're writing it. And even if you go back the next day and screw it up and write it again, mm-hmm. I think the important thing is to write something, even though you may not feel like you're entirely in the zone and what you write may not be very good. I think it's important to keep the kind of routine of writing going.
I agree. It's so important. Would you like to confess one of your guilty pleasures?
Wow. I don't know how many of them are guilty. Do you know what? I can confess a disgusting one.
Okay.
I love eating cold baked beans mixed with cottage cheese.
Oh, that's interesting. I haven't had that one before.
My kids tell me it looks like a bowl of sick.
I think your kids are right.
yeah, they are. It was something my mum used to eat. And I just like it. And, you know, everyone else thinks it's absolutely vile and disgusting. But that's my guilty pleasure, aside from chocolate.
Okay, there you go, everyone. A new breakfast option for you tomorrow morning. Now, what three new skills would you like to learn?
I'd love to be able to read medieval Latin. I actually did Latin at school up to GCSE, but, you know, it's very different from trying to read medieval Latin. I wouldn't pretend I can do that now. But so much of what we have is still untranslated. That sometimes not being able to read it can be frustrating because you look up a source and you realise it's in Latin and it's back to square one. I'd love to be able to draw or paint. I'm an atrocious artist. If I drew you a stick man, you'd ask what it was. But lots of my family are really good artists. My dad was a good artist. I had a great uncle who had an exhibition at an art gallery. My son is an amazing drawer. Wow. My daughter is an amazing drawer. But I just cannot do it at all. I would love to learn a trick to doing it. I think I'd love to learn to play an instrument. I never really learned to play an instrument. I started learning the cello when I was at junior school. So when I was probably about 9 or 10 and the cello was bigger than me. And that put me off, I think. But I'd love to be able to I love it when people can just pick up an instrument and play something off the top of their head.
Yeah, it's fantastic. What was your first paid job?
My first paid job was working in a solicitor's in Wolverhampton in school holidays and things like that. So my parents always wanted me to be a solicitor. And I did law at university rather than history. And the first year of my law degree was enough to put me off the idea of practicing law. But I used to go and work at this solicitor's in town in the school holidays and things, and I would have done it for nothing, you know, but they very generously paid me for it. And that taught me, you know, some of the solicitors there were really, really nice, and they were happy to talk to me, and they've taught me an awful lot. I mean, I think one of the things I really took away from that job that applies to what I'm doing now is one of the solicitors told me that, you know, no lawyer will know all of the law. Mm-hmm. It's about knowing where to go and find what you need to know.
Yeah.
And I think applies to history as well. You know, you can't know all of history and all of what everyone says about everything, but it's about knowing having the research skills to chase down things that you need to know.
That is really, really good advice to keep in mind, definitely. So if a friend's taking you out for a drink, what's your drink of choice?
Wow, so many. This is going to sound horrible because I actually don't drink a lot.
That's good.
I have a lot of drinks that I like. Right. So if I reel them all off, it's going to sound like I'm an horrendous alcoholic. but I actually don't drink very much. But I love red wine, Chilean red wine particularly. I like German kind of sweet white wines. I love port. I love brandy. I love cider. See, it sounds like I'm an alcoholic.
See, you love most things, most alcoholic drinks.
Southern Comfort lemon and lime. I'm going to stop there because it sounds awful. I really don't drink a lot.
I believe you. Lucky last question. You've recently written a book about Richard III as well, which I'm really looking forward to reading. So when you hear the word Richard III, what's the first word that comes to mind?
Maligned, I think. No, it's an old word that people use for Richard III, but I think it's true. And I think for a lot of people, seeing Richard III as a monster is—I don't want to sound this to sound too horrible—but I think it's like a lazy response.
Yeah.
It comes from not understanding what was happening in his life and what was going on around him.
Mm-hmm. That's all right. Okay. So maligned. Okay. Excellent. Now it's time for your Tudor takeaway. So this is just a little gem, something for us to take away and go and explore after the episode. Do you have a Tudor takeaway for us?
I've got two because everyone else has two, so I want two.
Excellent. I love
two. So I've gone for a website first, and I don't know how well known this really is, but I absolutely love it. It's called archive.org.
Yes.
It's a collection of online kind of scanned books. They're all out of copyright, so it's books that are over 100 years old. But it includes all sorts of chronicles, Victorian histories. We get calendars, estate papers, parliament rolls, all of that kind of material that's really, you know, invaluable. And it's all sat there for free. So I really think that's it's a website that's worth a good rummage around if you've got a spare few days to lose down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And I think my other one is a place to visit.
Yes, yes.
And I think that's Ludlow. I absolutely love Ludlow. I don't live too far away from Ludlow.
Me too.
And it's a town that's, you know, it's absolutely steeped in kind of medieval history. There's the stunning castle there, the Church of St. Leonard's, just down the road from the castle, is absolutely filled with Yorkist iconography in particular. It's where Edward V was based. It's where Arthur Tudor dies.
Yes,
where his heart buried at St. Leonard's Church. There's a plaque on the floor in St. Leonard's Church. But especially for me, you know, being interested in the Wars of the Roses just before the Tudors, for Ludlow Castle, you know, I can stand in Ludlow Castle in October or the autumn of 1459. We've got gathered in Ludlow Castle, we get Richard, Duke of York, who I've written a biography of, Cecily Neville, his wife. We get Warwick the Kingmaker, the future King Edward IV, the future King Richard III, Margaret of Burgundy. You know, all of these people are walking around those grounds. It's where Edward V is based as Prince of Wales. It's where Arthur Tudor goes, and where Catherine of Aragon lives with him for, you know, their very short marriage.
Right.
And I think when I think you, Sarah Morris, talk about the feeling of a place, for me, that's Ludlow. And quite often, if I get kind of a bit of writer's block or something, a day out in Ludlow fixes that for me. You know, you walk around that castle and you think of the people who walked there, sat there, touched those stones. I get a real feeling for that place.
Absolutely, I agree with you. I was lucky enough to go there when I was researching the book I wrote with Sarah about the six wives. Wow, that has just absolutely etched itself onto my heart. It's an amazing atmospheric place, and completely agree with you.
It's a little bit out of the way, really, from the usual.
It is, which is nice.
But I think it's worth the trip.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you so much, Matt, for joining me on Talking Tudors. It's been really fantastic. And I think we've given people lots to kind of think about. So I look forward to chatting with you again soon.
Thanks very much, Natalie.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.